Chapter 11. She made no answer. "Say you hate me," he persisted. That would have been so simple, she answered with a strange smile. She dropped into a chair near the writing table and rested about forehead on her hand. "Was it much?" she began at length. "Much," he returned, vaguely. "The money." "The money?" That part of it seemed to count so little that for a moment he did not follow her thought. "It must be paid back," she insisted. "And you do it?" "Oh, yes," he returned, listlessly. "Can do it." "I would make any sacrifice for that," she urged. He nodded. "Of course." He sat staring at her in dry-eyed self-contempt. "Oh, you count on it's making much difference?" "Much difference?" "In the way I feel, or you feel about me." She shook her head. "It's the least part of it," he groaned. "It's the only part we can repair." "Good heavens!" If there were any reparation, he rose quickly and crossed the space that divided them. "Why did you never speak?" he asked. "Haven't you answered that yourself?" "Answered it?" "Just now when you told me you did it for me." She paused a moment and then went on with a deepening note, "would have spoken if I could have helped you. But you must have despised me. I've told you that would have been simpler. But how could you go on like this, hating the money? I knew you would speak in time. I wanted you, first, to hate it as I did." He gazed at her with a kind of awe. "You're wonderful," he murmured. "But you don't yet know the depths I've reached." She raised an entreating hand. "Don't want to." "You're afraid, then, that you'll hate me?" "No, but that you'll hate me. Let me understand without your telling me." "You can't. It's too base. I thought you didn't care, because you loved Flamel." She blushed deeply. "Don't," she warned him. "I haven't the right to, you mean?" "I mean that you will be sorry." He stood imploringly before her. "Want to say something worse, something more outrageous. If you don't understand this, you will be perfectly justified in ordering me out of the house." She answered him with a glance of divination. "She'll understand, but you will be sorry." "I must take my chance of that." He moved away and tossed the books about the table. Then he swung round and faced her. "Does Flamel care for you?" he asked. Her flush deepened, but she still looked at him without anger. "What would be the use?" she said with a note of sadness.
I didn't ask that," he penitently murmured. "Well, then," to this adjuration he made no response beyond that of gazing at her with an eye which seemed now to view her as a mere factor in an immense redistribution of meanings. "I insulted Flamel today. I let him see that I suspected him of having told you. I hated him because he knew about the letters." He caught the spreading horror of her eyes, and for an instant he had to grapple with the new temptation they lit up. Then he said, with an effort, "Don't blame him, he's impeccable. He helped me to get them published, but I lied to him too. I pretended they were written to another man. A man who was dead." She raised her arms in a gesture that seemed to ward off his blows. "You do despise me," he insisted.
That poor woman, that poor woman," he heard her murmur. "I spare no one, you see," he triumphed over her. She kept her face hidden. "You do hate me, you do despise me," he strangely exulted. "Be silent," she commanded him, but he seemed no longer conscious of any check on his gathering purpose. "He cared for you, he cared for you," he repeated, "and he never told you of the letters." She sprang to her feet. "How can you?" she flamed. "How dare you?" That glimmered was ashy pale. "He's a weapon. Like another. A scoundrel's." He smiled wretchedly. "Should have used it in his place. Stephen. Stephen," she cried, as though to drown the blasphemy on his lips. She swept to him with a rescuing gesture. "Don't say such things. I forbid you. It degrades us both." He put her back with trembling hands. "Nothing that I say of myself can degrade you. We're on different levels. I'm on yours, whatever it is." He lifted his head and their gaze flowed together.
Ziv, the great renewals take effect as imperceptibly as the first workings of spring. Glenard, though he felt himself brought nearer to his wife, was still, as it were, hardly within speaking distance. He was but laboriously acquiring the rudiments of their new medium of communication, and he had to grope for her through the dense fog of his humiliation, the distorting vapor against which his personality loomed grotesque and mean. Only the fact that we are unaware how well our nearest know us enables us to live with them. Love is the most impregnable refuge of self-esteem, and we hate the eye that reaches to our nakedness. If Glenard did not hate his wife, it was slowly, sufferingly, that there was born in him that profounder passion which made his earlier feeling seem a mere commotion of the blood. He was like a child coming back to the sense of an enveloping presence. Her nearness was a breast on which he leaned. They did not, at first, talk much together, and each beat a devious track about the outskirts of the subject that lay between them like a haunted wood. But every word, every action, seemed to glance at it, to draw toward it, as though a fount of healing sprang in its poisoned shade. If only they might cut a way through the thicket to that restoring spring. Glenard, watching his wife with the intentness of a wanderer to whom no natural sign is negligible, saw that as he had taken temporary refuge in the purpose of renouncing the money, if both, theoretically, owned the inefficacy of such amends, the woman's instinctive subjectiveness made her find relief in this crude form of penance. Glenard saw that she meant to live as frugally as possible till what she deemed their debt was discharged, and he prayed she might not discover how far-reaching, in its merely material sense, was the obligation she thus hoped to acquit. Her mind was fixed on the sum originally paid for the letters, and this he knew he could lay aside in a year or two. He was touched, meanwhile, by the spirit that made her discard the petty luxuries which she regarded as the signs of their bondage. Their shared renunciations drew her nearer to him, helped, in their evidence of her helplessness, to restore the full protecting stature of his love. And still they did not speak. It was several weeks later that, one afternoon by the drawing-room fire, she handed him a letter that as he had been reading when he entered. "I've heard from Mr. Flamel," she said. Glenard turned pale. It was as though a latent presence had suddenly become visible to both. He took the letter mechanically. "It's from Smyrna," she said. "Aren't you read it?" He handed it back. "Who can tell me about it? Is hand so illegible?" He wandered to the other end of the room, and then turned and stood before her. "I've been thinking of writing to Flamel," he said. She looked up. "There's one point," he continued, slowly, "that I ought to clear up. I told him you'd known about the letters all along, for a long time, at least, and I saw it hurt him horribly. It was just what I meant to do, of course, but I can't leave him to that false impression. I must write him." She received this without outward movement, but he saw that the depths were stirred. At length she returned, in a hesitating tone, "Why do you call it a false impression?" "I did know." "Yes, but I implied you didn't care." "Ah." He still stood looking down on her. "Aren't you want me to set that right?" he tentatively pursued. She lifted her head and fixed him bravely. "He isn't necessary," she said. Glenard flushed with the shock of the retort. Then, with a gesture of comprehension, "No," he said, "comma with you it couldn't be, but I might still set myself right." She looked at him gently. "Aren't I," she murmured, "do that? And being yourself merely? Alas, the rehabilitation's too complete. You make me seem to myself even what I'm not, what I can never be. I can't, at times, defend myself from the delusion, but I can at least enlighten others." The flood was loosened, and kneeling by her, he caught her hands. "Don't you see that it's become an obsession with me? That if I could strip myself down to the last lie only there'd always be another one left under it. And do penance naked in the marketplace, I should at least have the relief of easing one anguish by another? Don't you see that the worst of my torture is the impossibility of such amends? Her hands lay in his without returning pressure. H. Poor woman, poor woman, he heard her sigh. Don't pity her, pity me. What have I done to her or to you, after all? You're both inaccessible. It was myself I sold. He took an abrupt turn away from her, then halted before her again. How much longer, he burst out, do you suppose you can stand it? You've been magnificent, you've been inspired, but what's the use? You can't wipe out the ignominy of it. It's miserable for you, and it does her no good. She lifted a vivid face. That's the thought I can't bear, she cried. What thought? That it does her no good, all your feeling, all your suffering. Can it be that it makes no difference? He avoided her challenging glance. That's done is done, he muttered. Is it ever, quite, I wonder, she mused. He made no answer, and they lapsed into one of the pauses that are a subterranean channel of communication. It was she who, after a while, began to speak with a new suffusing diffidence that made him turn a roused eye on her. Don't they say, she asked, feeling her way as in a kind of tender apprehensiveness, that the early Christians, instead of pulling down the heathen temples, the temples of the unclean gods, purified them by turning them to their own uses? I've always thought one might do that with one's actions, the actions one loathes but can't undo. One can make, I mean, a wrong the door to other wrongs, or an impassable wall against them. Her voice wavered on the word. He can't always tear down the temples we've built to the unclean gods, but we can put good spirits in the house of evil, the spirits of mercy and shame and understanding, that might never have come to us if we hadn't been in such great need. She moved over to him and laid a hesitating hand on his. His head was bent and he did not change his attitude. She sat down beside him without speaking. But their silences now were fertile as rain clouds, they quickened the seeds of understanding. At length he looked up. Don't know, he said, what spirits have come to live in the house of evil that I built, but you're there, and that's enough for me. It's strange, he went on after another pause, she wished the best for me so often, and now, at last, it's through her that it's come to me. But for her I... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.